Podcast listeners, you've listened to the podcast. Now you want the chance to come on the program yourself. So here it is. Do you remember those books, Choose Your Own Adventure, where you would pick where to go next and follow that story? Well, help us flesh out the VitBuckle Society complication session at the annual meeting in March 2020 by submitting your surgical videos of your complications in vitreoretinal surgery. These videos can be narrated or anonymous with the description to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. We all learn more from reviewing our mistakes as groups and with our colleagues, so this is a great learning opportunity. And two big things, the top five entries will be shown during the meeting and discussed by a panel discussion. But more importantly, if you're one of the top five entries, we'll invite you to come on the podcast for a one-on-one interview to discuss the case and learning points. The winning entry out of the five will then win a special VitBuckle Society buckle. So send your entries to mklufas@gmail.com. That's mklufas@gmail.com. Thank you.
Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, we have the distinct pleasure of being joined by Dr. Kirk Pacco. We discuss his career as well as his background with the Vitreous Society, now known as the American Society of Retina Specialists, and his thoughts on training fellows and other topics. As always, a list of financial disclosures will be found in the episode description. Remember that podcasts are now eligible for CME credits on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Simply click on the link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth now has the distinct pleasure and honor of being joined by Dr. Kirk Pacco. Dr. Pacco is partner at Illinois Retina Associates in Chicago, Illinois. In addition, he is the chair and director of the retina service in the ophthalmology department at Rush University. Dr. Pacco, thank you so much for taking your time to join us.
Happy to be with you, Jay. Appreciate it.
It's your first time on the program, and we always ask first-time guests the same question, especially because we have a lot of listeners early in their careers, is why did Kirk Pacco decide to become an ophthalmologist? And at what point did you then say, I want to be a retina specialist?
Well, a lot of people, I think, come into ophthalmology knowing in their first year of medical school they want to do it. Part of it is the game you play with getting involved in research and showing that you're committed to this. I didn't come into this until my third year. And I think part of finding ophthalmology stemmed from growing up with a photographer as a father. And the lingo was familiar. Ophthalmology is a very photographic field anyway. It certainly was back then when there was film and slides that we used. So things like diopters and lenses and depth of field was familiar to me. And then it happened on a single night, actually. I tell the medical students about this, where I was a third-year medical student in the ICU. We had one admission to the ICU that night of a young man in ketoacidosis, and he was comatose, and he had extraordinary pathology in his eyes. And the intern I was teamed with was going into ophthalmology. And we dilated this fellow's eyes, and all night long, classic all-nighter, I did nothing but study his eyes with a direct ophthalmoscope. And between trips to the lab, we would stop in the library. I looked at my first copy of the Archives of Ophthalmology, opened a couple of textbooks. The intern would point out, if you go supranasally, look at this, this, and this. And by morning, I was absolutely sold. The beauty of seeing the retina was so powerful. And I thought, oh, my God, this is for me, let alone the lingo being comfortable. So I called my mother with great excitement. And I told my mom, decided to go into ophthalmology, and there was silence. And she didn't say anything. And I said, Mom, you hear what I'm saying? And she finally speaks up and says, all these years of training, and you want to go work at Sears. I don't get it. And she just recently passed away last year at age 91. And, you know, up for the next 40 years, whenever I'd get together, she says, well, so how's your office at Sears? And I would joke with her about that, I'm really a real doctor, where you operate and everything. So that's how I kind of came into it. And retina, I guess probably stemmed from that too, Jay. But it's, you know, we get turned on to by role models. And I was surrounded at the University of Illinois with some extraordinary role models in retina back then. Lee Jampel, Mort Goldberg, those, you know, Tom Solzano is retired out in California. And he just got me excited about retina and just the beauty of crawling into the eye and seeing surgery where it's like moonwalking. I thought, well, this is for me. And this is the real heart of ophthalmology is knowing retina. So I'm thrilled to be part of that that family.
You know, it's so interesting what you mentioned about your mom's initial impression, because I do some talking to medical students. I'm sure you do as well. And you know, people ask, you know, why did you pick ophthalmology? Are there pros and cons? And I mentioned it as a con, and I said, it doesn't have to be a con, but I think that one of the cons is if you go to the general medical world, there's some misconceptions and some confusion about what an eye provider does, you know, what an ophthalmologist or a retina specialist or an optometrist do or an optician do. People have a lot of confusion amongst these terms. And, you know, I say for some people that, you know, if you view yourself as a doctor, I think most ophthalmologists are happy and it doesn't bother them. But that is something you have to keep in mind, is there, you know, it isn't as clear cut as being an internist or cardiologist in the minds of the layperson, at least for now. And though we've done a better job via the academy and other routes of maybe educating the public.
Well, in the fight that everybody points to is ophthalmology versus optometry, in trying to educate the lawmakers of the difference in our scope of practice to be protected. But, you know, I think the crisis really, and this is pointed out to me a number of years ago, which is really true, and I see this as a chairman, is educating our own physician colleagues about what we do. I think that's an important part. And most other MDs and DOs don't really know the difference between all of the different types of eye providers, as well as even the subspecialists. What is a retinal specialist any different than a comprehensive specialist? And a lot of endocrinologists will refer their patients to an optometrist instead of an ophthalmologist for their diabetic patient care. So, and ophthalmology is constantly being deprioritized in universities. And we fight, actually, we had a big fight to keep our big first-year medical student exposure in their curriculum. It was going to be cut out. So, again, getting to the other MDs is a real important part of what we need to do as eye doctors, too.
Dr. Pacco, you know, you've had multiple roles locally, nationally. I know the American Society of Retina Specialists, you spent a lot of time with the ASRS. And we'll talk a little bit about your history with the ASRS and its origins. They recently gave the first annual Kirk Pacco Award in honor of your service to ASRS. And one of the things that you talked about and they mentioned during that talk that I thought was super interesting, you referenced your background in photography and how that tied into your knowing some background in lenses and ophthalmology. But you're kind of a big film and theater buff, like not just in terms of consumption, but in producing your own work. How have you kind of tied that with your work? So what, you know, what sort of things have you done? I know you do collect vintage movie posters, things like that. But what sort of things have you done to kind of promote the field, as you said, and for education in terms of connecting those two loves?
You know, Jay, there's no such thing as any educational experience which is invaluable to you, and my education through college and even started in high school was I got interested in drama. And when I was in college, I double majored in speech and drama along with pre-medical studies. And for a brief time, I actually had designs to go into acting professionally or directing perhaps. And I studied acting in New York for a little while and things. And then I kind of came to my senses and came back to medicine and moved on. But that experience in dealing with theater was a great tool for me in presentations and learning how to get a message across to a, quote, audience. And that audience can be other physicians or other patients. I go into every exam room every day, and I teach my residents this. It's hand on the doorknob, and I walk in, and it's like showtime. It's like walking out on stage. And I work with the patients in an improvisational manner, and there's rules to improv that I learned in some summer stock things, where if the patient, what I say, throws you something, gives you a fact, you got to work with it. You don't discount that. And you go right back with him. You get this conversation back and forth, and you engage them. The perfect a golden rule of acting is reacting and listening to other people. Accomplished actors will tell you that all the time. And that's a great rule of thumb for physicians, too. And unfortunately, now we have our nose in a computer, and you're not paying attention to patients. Instead of maintaining eye contact and working with them and using what they tell you as the next line that comes out of your mouth. And then from an organizational standpoint, I was really interested in directing and running productions and things in college and through my training. And that served me well in doing things with meetings and presentations. People point to me as being kind of this Yoda of PowerPoint, and I love PowerPoint presentations. And I laugh, you know, put a spotlight in the microphone, and you'll find Paco elbowing his way in there. It's kind of like finding the spotlight, which I love to do. And I love speaking in front of other people, but my training helped me with that. And again, that's why part of my love of education is sharing that with my audience, which is my students, fellows, and residents, and so on.
You know, let's talk a little bit about ASRS, which was not originally called ASRS, though many people of my generation younger may not realize that. One of the things they did talk about when they were giving your award was the background of ASRS and how it came to be and the origins. Jerry Bovino actually came on the podcast, you know, 6 months ago or something, and he was one of the founders, and he talked a little bit about the origins. From your perspective, you know, how did ASRS kind of tie into your life? Because ASRS was not the predominant or even a prominent organization. It came from nothing. It was made, built by the ideas of people and grew into the organization it is today. Tell us a little bit about your perspective, how you became involved, and how you've seen the organization evolve over the last couple decades.
Well, you know, it was an interesting set of events that happened in my life that got me to the ASRS. The first is how I actually got into ophthalmology, and I mentioned this during my presentation at the ASRS recently, is that that was the first year of the match when I was applying, and I applied to 15 programs and got offers from zero. So I was one of these people that opened up that envelope and said, you have received no offers. And I was devastated, and I thought, well, there goes ophthalmology. And part of it was my theater background, I think, and people actually told me that afterwards. I was a little too out of the box as part of the people applying. They didn't want to take a chance on a guy who studied acting in New York for a while. But I found out that my number one choice at the University of Illinois, which I fell in love with, still had an opening. So I went back and re-interviewed with Mort Goldberg. And Mort told me that at that time that he really wanted to train people that were contributors and people who made a difference in their life. And I was desperate to get the spot, and I leaned forward and I said, Dr. Goldberg, you give me this chance and I'll show you what I can do. I just need the opportunity. And I even told him, I says, you know, 10 years from now, you and I can look back on this and see if I made good on the promise. So he kind of smiles at my chutzpah or boldness in saying that, but he gave me the spot. So I was committed to make good on that promise. So when I came out of my fellowship, I was geared up to be a contributor, and I felt I wanted to be an academician. I wanted to publish, I wanted to present, and I wanted most to be in the Retina Society, which was a badge of honor. Mm-hmm. And I was gearing up to do that and getting my CV in enough shape where I could get voted into it. And Andy Packer came to me and told me about the Vitreous Society. Andy, I think, was president-elect then, a retinal specialist out in Connecticut, wonderful guy. And he says, Kirk, you ought to think about joining the Vitreous Society, which I thought was the stupidest society in the world. I laughed at the name. I thought that's ridiculous, and it's just a bunch of people who have no credentials anyway that are putting a group together and guessed up this, you know, ancillary name that was only the leftovers. But when I got into the society, and I joined it just out of friendship with Andy, and Andy was on the board, and he knew me, and put me on a committee on the board back then. And when I got there, then my eyes opened up because I thought, oh my God, this is a really spectacular group. And it was all founded, as you learned with Jerry, who was on the podcast before, but you know, they did it as an open society, very different than the Retina or Macula Society. And you didn't have to have a CV that was 100 pages long. You didn't have to have a CV, period. As long as you were retina trained and you needed a place to go, you could go to this society and go to their meetings. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And part of that commitment to be a contributor, I thought, well, I'm going to dig my heels in and be a contributor. So for the next 20 years, I worked my way through the board suggesting all sorts of stuff, including tons of controversial things, which I'm sure Jerry went over to, including the name change. I felt that the name had to go, and I wasn't there at the start, so I didn't have the family nostalgia to the term Vitreous Society. I just knew what the Vitreous Society could be if it was destined to start working in Washington and with the FDA and being there for all things retina, more than just a meeting. And it slowly happened with a lot of battle scars. There was an impeachment trial when I was on the board where I was just way too revolutionary with a lot of things I was suggesting. And again, in tribute really to Jerry of the three founders was amazing. And all three guys were great. But Jerry was amazing because he always said after the fighting was done and all the smoke cleared and the heat died down at the board meetings, everybody was ready to kill me. They said, well, let's give Kirk a try. Let's give this a chance. And as I look back on it, almost every single thing I put forward ultimately got pointed to as a wonderful thing for the society and was built on by other people. And it culminated in that amazing award that you alluded to that I got a few months ago. And I'll correct you with one thing, Jay. It's not the Kirk Pacco Award. It is the Pacco Award. And there's a little difference there because that award that 100 years from now, someone's going to get the Pacco Award, it belongs to my family and my wife and my son in particular, who all those 20 years I was on the board, spending 1,000 hours doing these things, you know, there's give and take. So I wasn't there for everything that the family had going on. I mentioned I missed a few of my son's hockey games. And my son, who loves me and I love him to death, he's now 40 years old. Back when he was a teenager, he had to give up dad to let dad do this kind of craziness. And that's why I'm thrilled that the award belongs to them too.
And, that's great.
It's really meaningful.
You know, in terms of other things, you know, you're very humble. You've very designed and invented a number of devices, and you hold the patents for a couple of those. Let's just talk, if you had to pick, I don't want to put you on the spot, but if you had to pick one thing that you were involved in creating from a technical perspective, from a device perspective, that you're the most proud of, or you're like, you know, if people haven't heard of this, this is actually something that I do think that changes the way you approach surgery. Which of those devices would you say if you had to write one thing on your epitaph, which of those devices would you pick and why?
That's a great question. I don't know which one I'd prioritize. I mean, there were some things I was really intimately involved with. I really worked hard on when the laser indirect ophthalmoscope was coming out, and Coherent was the company before Luminous was designing and developing that. I was helpful in getting that off the ground, helpful a lot with the Acuras, with Alcon, and working on some different hand instruments and things. I guess there's two things I'd like to say. One, people don't realize how gases got FDA approved. And there was a time when we lost access to gases because you couldn't buy it on the industrial market anymore. The industry people said enough's enough on this and they don't want the liability. So there was a year or two where we were without a way to get it. And the FDA wanted that yoke off their back and they were just begging for a company to come forward to do it. So I put together a big list of literature and a whole write-up and approached a company called Scott Medical, who was providing the gas for the silicone oil study. And they were an anesthesia gas company, and they wanted nothing to do with the ophthalmic market. But I convinced them pretty much alone by myself to put forth a PMA application to the FDA and help them get it off the ground and push them and help them write the package insert and get it FDA approved. And got paid a zero, not a penny for that. But the funny part of that story is the reason I got involved with it is that I had my last tank in the operating room and another retinal specialist, not part of my group in my hospital, wanted to use the tank. And this nurse called me and said, can Dr. So-and-so use my gas? And I didn't know how much was left in it. You couldn't buy it anymore. You know, something I personally bought and just had in the corner there. And I said, you know, I have to really decline. I don't know how much is left. And he was so angry with that he then sent a letter to the hospital saying that I was using non-FDA-approved gases.
Oh, wow.
And I need to be stopped. And the hospital came to me and says, what are you doing? But the president of the hospital, after my explanation, said, okay, we understand this, but you still got to go through an IRB now. So I wrote up this long document for the IRB. When I was done, that's when I said, I'm not going to end here. So I personally carried it to Scott Medical, which is basically my IRB write-up. So my ticket to heaven for retina is the fact that I got gases FDA approved very quickly. And it would have happened without me. It was destined to happen. But it was also because of the jealousy of another retina person who wanted it. So I look back on that little story that no one knows about fondly. I think that my fondest thing in instrumentation is not so much of the things I had patents on or little individual things, but the concept of working through, and I chose to work with Alcon, but B&L is on that list too, and other companies that made the integrated our vitrectomy machines, and working through the Accutome and the Acuras and the Constellation, and again, other people with the Stellaris and so on. I made it my mission to really know the instruments, and I worked with a lot of the R&D people, and there's some modules that I added. The whole gas delivery system in the Constellation was something that I really was intimately involved with, and changed their old designs and pushed them to put it in. They weren't going to have that in there at all. But I got them to put the gas delivery as part of the Constellation. So little nuances like that. The brains behind the Constellation, of course, is Steve Charles. But then learning it and then teaching it and teaching people the concept of fluidics, educating myself about fluidics was wonderful challenge for me over the years. And that's what I look back on instrument-wise I've loved to do is to really know the instruments that we actually operate with. And then the last contribution, too, is that Gene Dewan, who's such a great friend and deserves all the 101% of the credit of bringing a small gauge surgery, Gene and I were working together, and I came up with an instrument on my own of the first transconjunctival 25-gauge probe, which at my limited thinking back then was I was going to use it for vitreous taps. And Gene looked at it and said, you know what, this would probably work for everything. And whether one built on the other, but you know, I was the guy that planted the seed on going through the conjunctiva with a 25-gauge probe, which we didn't think we could pull off on the fluidics of it. And then look how that's changed what we do now too. So it's fun to see this and talk about it and work with great people too, because it's all building on each other's learning curves.
We haven't talked much about the OR besides abstractly in terms of devices, things like that. Let's talk about when you take a fellow to the OR. So you work with fellows, you have a trainee with you in the OR. Let's say it's day one. Fellow's never been in a retina OR. They've done some cataracts as a cataract surgeon. If they had to take three lessons home with them first day, and let's say the cases, every case is different. Let's say they're macular cases or a couple of simple RDs. What are kind of the three biggest take home points to take that fellow's going to go home, write three notes, say, Dr. Paco taught me X?
Well, here's my rule on it. And I talked with our first year fellow this year, and I sat him down as a guy this year, and I asked him, what kind of retinal surgeon do you want to be? Do you want to be a person that does, just simple things and fluorectomies and closed macular holes, or do you want to do really challenging stuff? And I said, you don't be honest with me. Just tell me how in depth you want to learn this. And he said, I want to learn everything. So I said, okay. So you start out, and then I said, well, I arrogantly said, I can make you the Michael Jordan of retina, but you got to do a couple of things for me. So here's my rules here in the golden pearls, Jay. The first thing I do with every fellow, I've been doing this for 35 years, is I hand them the manual of the machines we use. So I hand over in the first week the manual to the Constellation. And I say, it's your job to know every single button, what every single screen does. And when something isn't working right, the last thing you can do is to turn to someone and say, get engineering or get somebody in here to fix it. You need to know how to troubleshoot everything. You got to know your instruments. And knowing your instruments means you know how to use it right, how to use it incorrectly, what can go wrong, how you can harm a patient, and the nuances of what you can do with it. A lot of retinal specialists don't know their instruments, don't even know the name of it. So that's, I think, number one, and being a Michael Jordan of maybe I'm showing my age, LeBron James, if you will, of retina. Number two, and something which I've been stressing for 30 years too, is that surgical training is not like engineering. And it's different from the office too a little bit, because it's not just a collection of learning facts. You're basically in an apprenticeship. That's why the fellowships are different around the world, because you're building on the learning curve of the people you're sitting next to. And there's lots of different ways to do things. And everybody has their own approach to it, and everybody has their own algorithms of and steps of doing it. And I'm a very organized person in the operating room. My desk at home may look like a mess, but in the operating room, I'm step one, two, three, four, and five. And things vary, and you need to be willing to go a different branch in your algorithm. But you can't remember this, and you think that you're dealing with some of the brightest people in the medical pyramid here. So you got incredibly bright people coming through as fellows, and you think that just sitting through 100 cases is enough. You got to write it down, and I really push people to write down between cases the steps. And I'll sit there and I'll draw them out. Here's step one, two, three. I'll make little drawings. And it's amazing that difference. And the fellows over the years that have not done that, it shows. And the fellows that have done it are extraordinary. So that's really, really critical. And you got to be willing to try things too. And don't get caught in just one way of doing it. I think if you're still doing the lion's share of your surgery the way you were doing it 10 years after your fellowship, you haven't kept up, because the field evolves. You always got to be willing to challenge yourself and say, is there a better way to do things? And be open-minded to try things. Those are kind of the big three. But writing it down and knowing your instruments and being willing to always want to make it better, you can't miss. And then the thing that bridges the surgery and the office together is something I was taught when I graduated medical school. The priest who baptized me came up at a party my parents threw for me and took me aside. He was close to 90 years old back then. And he said, you know, I held you in my hands when you were first born. He said, I want you to do something for me. He says, now that you're a doctor, he says, I want you to treat one patient for free every day, and you'll have the richest practice in the world. And that, it sounds like a cliche and almost a flowery to say that, but Jay, it's so true. Basically, what this guy was telling me is just do the right thing. There's never the right time to do the wrong thing. And you want it done the way you would do it in your own eye. So just do the right thing. Don't be pushed by money. Don't do something in the operating room because you can code better for it. Don't get fancy. Just do the right thing, and you'll have the richest practice in the world. It can be rich financially or rich emotionally, but it's the way to do it.
That's great. And I guess the last thing to kind of finish off, we talked a lot about the OR, and a lot of the things you referenced about the OR, especially taking notes, are critical for fellows observing in the clinic. I think we spend a lot of time talking about the OR, but retina specialists, as we've talked about, spend most of their time in the clinic, not in the operating room. Even for patients who have surgery, you're going to spend more time talking about surgery before and taking care of them afterwards, a post-op patient. Someone's observing you in clinic, forgetting nitty-gritty, just the bare bones of communication, empathy, you know, creating relationships with patients who have to do treatment sometimes for months and months and months and years of time right now with injections. What are kind of the biggest things to maintain that in the face of pressures to be efficient?
Well, one of the things that is a challenge for people training now, which I didn't have, is the electronic record. The electronic record has a lot of pitfalls to it, and people training now don't know anything different. And what I've seen since the EMR started is the fact that out of survival and the fact that you have to click so many mouse clicks and pull down so many menus that you just can't afford to be real exacting with your documentation. So you tend to minimize all the adjectives. You don't put the size of things, the grade of things, the actual location of stuff, location laterally versus how deep in the retina and all these little things. It'll say hemorrhage, macular hemorrhage, edema, fluid someplace, without all the qualifiers to it. So, and then your observational skills start to suffer because you're not forcing yourself to document all these things. So that's a big, big challenge, I think, that people training now have to overcome. And I'm constantly pushing people that are with me in the clinic and fellows and residents to make sure you're really documenting things well. And I like to downplay all the other stuff that my administrators say, no, you got to have, you know, the fact that you discuss smoking history and reconciliation of drugs and things like that, or else, you know, it's going to get kicked out and denied. So there is the hardship of doing all that. But in the end, you still got to do the right thing, right? And you got to document it correctly. So that's the big challenge that you have. And managing expectations in the office of the patient is so critical. And again, just like that, acting, reacting, listen to them. Don't have your nose stuck in the computer. I love the moment when I talk to patients, because it's almost a ceremonial thing. I pull my chair right up next to the arm of their chair, and I look them directly in the eye, and I make sure that I'm not in the computer, and I talk eye to eye with them. And I'm leaning right next to them and talking. And patients react to that, and they go away. How do I get a patient who's count fingers, hand motion, leaving my office thinking, yeah, this doctor was a great doctor and they took good care of me? And it's because I'm trying to do that, and I'm talking to them one-on-one and not through a computer screen.
That's great. Yeah, I think that it's so difficult. I mean, you've got to make an active effort to do it. You know, people have talked about rearranging the room so the computer and the patient are kind of oriented in the same direction, so you can maintain that eye contact. Right. You never turn the back to them. But I almost, even though ergonomically, I almost prefer it the other way, because it forces you to kind of turn completely away. Yep. When you talk to the patient. So you have no distraction. Sure. In your peripheral vision.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not as practical. Maybe you create the illusion that you're engaged the whole time, but it really can't be engaged unless you're, like you said, you're fully kind of turned and having that discussion with somebody.
There is a little process to it, a little smoke and mirrors. I use my acting terminology here. I tell my residents, you want to sit open to the people in the room. It's an acting term where you don't want to have your back to your audience usually. So when I talk to the patient one-on-one, I usually spin my chair around so that the family member on the other side of the room is not looking at my back either. So that, and that's a conscious thing. And I'm consciously aware of where my hands are. They're folded neatly in my lap. They're not crossed across my chest in a confrontational way. Now, it's those subliminal things. Touching them lightly on the hand releases endorphins and positive things. The people's pupils will dilate when you, and another human being touches you typically. So all these little nuances add up. In the end, you got to make sure you're solving their eye problem and managing the expectations of what they came there to learn from you that day. But there's a whole package to it, which is why I still love doing what I do, and I love going to the office every day to do this kind of stuff. And I love sharing it with other students as well.
Dr. Paco, you've been super generous with your time, as always. I really appreciate talking. It's always great talking to you, and could talk to you for another 2 hours and enjoy it. But I know you're busy. I'll let you go. I know you're preparing for the Academy meeting. So have a safe travels to San Francisco, and thank you for your time.
Thanks, Jay, and thanks to you, too. This blog is a wonderful series. It's a great resource for people, and I hope a lot of people listen to it. Thanks.
Take care. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all other episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All 202, yes, 202 episodes can be found there, sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. Remember, you can claim CME credits for this podcast and other podcast episodes on the AAO website. Simply log in as an AAO member and click on the link in the episode description. On our website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcasts and Android Store. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the Apple Podcasts or Android Store on your mobile device. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback, both on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Kirk Paco for joining me. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai, Dr. Angela Chang, and Dr. Michael Benincasa for preparing this episode. Finally, listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patient care you provide, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
feeling?
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.
Take care. Bye-bye.